It is 1981 in New York City, a distant planet, hard to see now. Beastie Boys is just being embryonically formed in a rehearsal space somewhere. Elsewhere, Cro-Mags, Motley Crue, Napalm Death, Run DMC, Sonic Youth, and Wham! Are likewise coagulating. In hospitals in other American cities, Beyoncé Knowles, Alicia Keys, Britney Spears, and Justin Timberlake are being born. Ronald Reagan has, since January 20th, been the 40th president of the nation. The personal listening cassette device known as the Walkman has been available in the United States since the previous summer, but it isn't cheap, and not many people have one. Instead, music is ambient throughout the city. It is everywhere, whether you like it or not. A song will come on WBLS as you're climbing the stairs from the subway station, and you'll catch it on a radio playing in a passing car, picked up by the outdoor speakers at a bodega, continued by a boombox hefted on the shoulder of somebody going the other way, resumed by another boombox, the basket of a bicycle weaving in and out of traffic, concluding in the pizza parlor where you've just entered to get a slice. Maybe the song is The Adventures of Grandmaster Flash on the Wheels of Steel, and it's brand new, first time you've heard it. So when you hear it in bits and pieces mixed with car horns and sirens, you don't realize at first it's all the same number. It sounds like an extended mix of Good Times by Chic, with assorted other radio stations cutting across it, playing Blondie, Queen, Spoonie G. That seems entirely plausible, because it's the sort of thing that happens all the time in New York City. Just as you can walk down one street and hear a single station emanating from every broadcast device, you can walk down the next block and hear Changa over here and Philly Soul over there and Skank down the way and Doo-Wop down that. The street itself can function as a mixing deck. If there's really a strong cut in the wind that week, it will serve as a moving backdrop, apparently always somewhere on the airwaves, while other sounds happen across it like billboards in a car window or quotes dropped in by a DJ. And Good Times has been audible somewhere seemingly every minute for the past 2 years. I don't know. It's hard for me to comprehend that the world we just heard about is now a distant memory. That the ubiquity of the internet and its wireless forms and earbuds and, most of all, air conditioning have combined to replace the mixtape, the boombox, the snatches of tunes pouring from windows upstairs, downstairs, cars, trucks, tractors. But that world is gone. Thank goodness it lasted long enough for the Beastie Boys to happen. Because the Beastie Boy book is more than just a collection of photos from back in the day, though it sure does have a lot of photos. It's more than the story of a punk band that forms in the early 1980s in the back streets of New York City and bursts upon the nation's consciousness with the all-time high school college 20-something theme song, Fight for Your Right to Party. Though certainly the ups and downs, the scares, the frights, the surprises, the joys of the band are front and center in this massive musical tome. We're talking over 500 pages. The Beastie Boys book is about the life and the times of one of the most chaotic, beloved, and strange bands America has produced. The stories of the late Adam Yauch, Mike Diamond, Mike D, and Adam Horowitz, Ad Rock, told with loving memories by the two living memories of the band, Diamond and Horowitz. I think the friendship these three teens who grew into manhood in their band had a friendship that started literally, as well as figuratively, when they were still young teens. That is the strongest glue that holds this very readable book together. The book follows a somewhat familiar approach these days. Each band member takes up the story in his own words as one chapter follows upon another. All the crazy stuff that these guys got into, sometimes on purpose, sometimes just because they happen to be the Beastie Boys, is on display in word and photo. And honestly, it makes me wonder what crazy kind of stuff they left out of all these stories that are told here. So, fair warning, there is enough swearing and cursing, albeit in print, to put off a few readers. I'm censoring the language I read from the book today, but you can read it for yourself by just picking it up at your favorite local library. To wit, it is impossible to pick up the Beastie Boys and not open it to a page that pulls you in immediately into their punk rock world, even at the beginning of their careers. We needed gigs, the story goes. So Yauch and I got a little package together with the demo we had made on 100 Streets and stickers and a photo. we kind of played it off like, yeah, we play shows. Look at this one we've got coming up. You could say we've made up for whatever we lacked in skill and experience with hustle and ambition, the ethos of hardcore in a net show. And our little act of false bravado worked. We landed a weekend slot at New York City's only real hardcore room, A7. Pretty much every New York hardcore band got a start at A7. Reagan Youth had played their first show there. Kraut, Adrenaline, OD, Agnostic Front, The Mob, Even Worse, and 100 other bands of disaffected teenagers all played their first shows in this dingy ground floor space. Playing A7 was like setting up in your friend's living room, your friend's small living room. The club was actually smaller than John Barry's loft. Couches lined the walls, and a low, small stage sat in one corner. The audience wasn't really separate from the performers. We were all part of this house party. So we got there, set up, and just started playing. When things got going, the crowd of 12 or so people would use the couches to launch off of, sort of stage diving into the room like many a suburban youth would do later in their garage. Our performance was neither triumph nor disaster. We made it through, mission accomplished, and another late night train or cab ride home. We had played a real show. And as Mike D would write, Yelk and I would sit around and listen to records endlessly and laugh about stuff. He was quiet, but with an unflappable intensity and focused enthusiasm. Whether for a record or an activity, he'd keep pushing you to listen, keep going until stuff was accomplished. He just had a greater degree of determination and decisiveness than the rest of us. He was also funny. It'll probably make no sense to you, but my favorite mannerism of his was this thing he and his friend Dave Wade would do. Back then, after somebody did something ridiculous or was the subject of a stinging insult, most kids would say, "Burn." It was the 1980s version of owned or wrecked. But Yauch and Wade had their own version of this, where they'd do this weird hand motion and say, "Boof." It was nonsensical and totally hilarious. If we had grown up most anywhere else in the world, our crew wouldn't have had such a steady flow of amazing events that we could all go to, unaccompanied by parents. First of all, in other cities, you'd have to drive to shows, which automatically meant a parent. And second, because all of our parents were artists or intellectuals, they gave us an unusual amount of freedom. It was still kind of the 70s in terms of parenting. My mom had certain time structures, like, you know, I couldn't be out late on a weeknight. I had to be clear about where I was and where I was going. But her basic attitude was, if your schoolwork doesn't suffer, you can do whatever you want. If it does, we have a problem. The authors write about their idolizing of other punk and rock bands from their pre-band youth all the way through their adult lives as music leaders themselves. This and other examples of the members' humble, their even in awe of their success attitude towards life, makes the Beastie Boys real-life punk rock fans in these pages, as well as the leaders in their field of music. And perhaps this is a key reason they are so beloved by their fans. Let's include His Holiness, the Dalai Lama, traveling the world to give concerts to thousands and thousands of fans, dressing up in costumes, getting high, getting drunk, doing all the kind of wacky and weird things the Beastie Boys were known for. It hits the reader, certainly this one, that the Beastie Boys kept their popularity and their audience for so long in large part because they never lost their youthful enthusiasm for life, for joking around and for exploring music. Something many of us wish we had been able to fashion in our lives. Heck, Amy Poehler writes a chapter titled Beastie Boys Video Review that delves into their made-for-TV antics. She starts it with these words. Beastie Boys mean a great deal to me. Their music was the soundtrack I heard while I sat in my room, drank in the woods, and rode my bike to my dead-end job. Their music played while I learned how to perform comedy and find a seat on the subway. Their music made me finally feel like a New Yorker. And like them, I grew and changed and went deeper and hopefully got better. These days, their music makes me feel old and young at the same time, which I'm finding is a delicious space to surf. So when I was asked to write about their videos for this book, I felt a huge sense of responsibility. How do I watch and rewatch 17 music videos that span an entire career and attempt to encapsulate what is so special about them? How do I comment on someone else's art in any kind of new or profound way? How do I try to insert my narrative into their impressive canon? And then I remembered, A good number of those videos are pretty dumb, so it should be easy. And of course, she's then off to talking about how great those videos of the Beastie Boys were. My unsophisticated guess is that years don't matter much to readers of this book. Though the music splashed across every page will, this is a who's who of the 1980s, the 1990s, the aughts, punk, hardcore music, with nods, too, to Stevie Wonder, The Clash, Merle Haggard. These guys in the Beastie Boys know their contemporary music. There's even an expanded mixtape list that band member Mike D thinks his late band member Adam Yauch would have loved. The mix of music here is emblematic of the boys' sounds. So if you're a Beastie Boys fan who wants to know the provenance of the Beastie Boys sound from the mouths of the band members themselves, this is your book. And heck, if you're just fascinated by this trio of guys who made such a big noise on the music scene, this is your book as well. I want to read from the almost last essay in the book, the last chapter, penned by Adam Horowitz, entitled The Last Gig. Here's how it starts, and here's how it ends. We didn't know it was going to be the last gig we'd ever play. Everything that happened that day was totally normal. The gig was headlining a huge festival in Tennessee. Thousands and thousands of people were going to be there, and we were the headliner. We went down to Tennessee early because we were going to shoot a video for a new song that hadn't come out yet. It was us, the rapper Nas, and Roman Coppola, the director. It was oddly normal for us to play these huge concerts and to have Roman with a Bolex camera filming us and Nas running around a supermarket and on some train tracks in Tennessee. The weirder, the more normal for us by then. Things in life never come full circle. Maybe once or twice they're hexagonal, but to me they're almost always misshapen, as if drawn by a toddler in crayon. There's common threads, sure. Yauch and me and Mike were still together. Still laughing, still family. Al Green was finishing his last set on the many stages of the festival, and so hearing his voice in the distance was comforting, just like how it was when I was in high school, in my bedroom, waiting for my friends to come over. But now with such a great distance from then, the rear view was nearly impossible to reposition. Kate wasn't there with us in Tennessee. Jill Cunniff and Rihanna Harris and Tanya Abey. John Barry wasn't there, Dave Skillen, Bosco, the captain, Dave Parsons, Mike's dad, my mom, and so many more not there. Me, Adam, and Mike were older, and we knew it. Still very much in the game, though, getting ready to start all over again. Headlining a huge festival is very different from a nice turnout at CBGB. But heck, man, we didn't know it was going to be the last show we'd ever play. From the last gig, by Adam Horowitz, one of the many memorable essays, chapters, call them what you will, in Beastie Boys' book. It's a huge 500-plus page homage by the band members themselves to that famous punk band from yesteryear. And Beastie Boys' book is available at all of our fine local libraries, including, of course, the West Lafayette Public Library.